on the line for mercy, and together we will proclaim liberty throughout the land for the enslaved, for the poor, and for us all.
Yeah! Follow that breaking news in Albany, where a large group of protesters have moved into the street.
Washington Avenue between City Hall and Lark Street closed down.
Protesters with the Poor People's Campaign of Indiana.
2 o'clock on the East Coast, 2 o'clock in the middle, 2 o'clock on the West Coast. A wave, and the historians tell us this never happened before.
Our communities, Muslim communities, who have joined the Poor People's Campaign, you can count on us.
Our democracy is in trouble.
Our democracy is in trouble.
And we come to demand.
And we come to demand.
I cannot stand here and claim to be a follower of Jesus Christ and be silenced about the moral outrage that is going on in our country.
Because it's crucial that we make ourselves heard. No one is listening. We write letters, we make calls. No one is listening. So we got to find a way to make ourselves heard.
We are the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. And we are here.
So, Senator, first of all, we welcome you here to Eastern North Carolina, to Goldsboro, to Greenlee Christian Church. Can we welcome the Senator?
Thank you very much.
And we do so, as we have done with other candidates, in a great spirit of love. Now, before we begin, I want to ask the Senator in a minute to just take 5 minutes before we get into policy and tell us who Bernie Sanders is. There are thousands of people online, 43 states in Washington, D.C., all over the country who are joining in. I do want to remind folk, and I'm going to step up here and say this because of something that was just whispered in my ear. This is a church. You don't want to disturb anything in here. I just want to say that. If you came planning anything, this is a holy church. Thank you. Senator, who is Bernie Sanders?
Well, let me begin by thanking everyone for being here and thanking Reverend Barbara for the invitation. And more importantly, for the extraordinary work he and this church are doing. I've been all over this country, and what I have seen is what is reflected in that video. And that is that there are millions of our people who are hurting. And what the Reverend is trying to do, what I think we all have got to do, is give courage to people to speak out on their pain. See, very often people are embarrassed and they say, it must be me. I'm the only person in America who is earning a low wage. I must be the only person in America who can't afford health care. I'm the only person in America who's homeless. Well, it turns out that the video was right, that there are tens and tens of millions of people who are hurting. And until people are prepared to stand up and say, hey, this is what's going on in my life, and it is wrong, and we have to stand together to change that, we will not bring about the fundamental changes that we need in this society. And that's not easy to do. It is not easy to do for people to stand up and say, you know what, I can't afford health care, or I'm 60 years of age and I have nothing in the bank for retirement. But that's what we have to do. Now, who is Bernie Sanders? Sometimes I wish I knew. Well, let me just tell you a little bit biographically. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and grew up in a rent-controlled apartment. My father, Reverend, was an immigrant. We talked about immigrants. He was an immigrant. He came to this country from Poland, from a very poor town, at the age of 17. And just a few years ago, my brother and my wife and my brother's wife went back to that very poor town in Poland. And I learned a whole lot, and it really did bring home to me the struggle of immigrants. Think about it. This is the story of millions of people, not just my own father. At the age of 17, without a nickel in your pocket, with very limited education, he didn't have much education, could not speak a word of English, he came to the United States. And he came here fleeing poverty and fleeing anti-Semitism. We're Jewish. And he never made much money. We grew up in a rent-controlled apartment. But as I think back on it, I think he was just extraordinarily proud that he could raise two kids who both went to college and have, if not a good standard of living, at least a decent standard of living, something that he never could have experienced back where he came from. And that he can go to sleep at night without thinking that somebody's going to raid the apartment because of our religion. So I grew up in a family that did not have a lot of money. And I grew up understanding that my father's family was wiped out by Hitler. And I remember as a kid reading, we didn't have a whole lot of books in the house, but we had a book called Life's, that was Life magazine. You remember Life magazine? Mm-hmm. They had this big volume of Life magazine's picture history of World War II. It's an extraordinary volume, photographs of the war from pre-Hitler to the end of the war. And I would be crying when I saw what was happening to the slaughter of the Jewish people. And it turns out that my father's family was wiped out by Hitler. So that issue of justice, how does it happen that a civilized nation like Germany, one of the most cultured nations in the world, falls for extreme white nationalism, if you like? A theory that says, I am an Aryan, whatever that means, and somehow or another, I'm superior to you. This is even white on white. All right? How does it happen that terrible, terrible things can take place, not only against the Jewish people, but against, you know, all people? So that has left a lasting impact in who I am as a person. So the combination, I think, of growing up in a family that did not have a lot of money and understanding the stress. I think in that video, people talk about stress. Some years ago, I was chairman of a Senate subcommittee, and we had a hearing, and it was called the Poverty as a Death Sentence. Poverty as a Death Sentence. And what that was about is doctors were describing the physiology of poverty. People know what I mean by that? The physiology of poverty. What happens to somebody who is worried whether or not they're going to put food on the table? What happens to somebody who is worried that they may lose their job and not be able to afford their family? What kind of stress does that bring to that individual? And it turns out that poor people, working class people, live under extraordinary stress every single day, which impacts their health. So there is a medical condition called the stress of poverty, which results in people living shorter lives.
You know, can I have this mic on, please? You know, Senator, first of all, thanks for telling us that part of your story, because, you know, in politics, we get a whole lot of people saying who we are, and very seldom get a chance to say who we are ourselves. So you hear in Goldsboro, Wayne County, you just came from Kinston area, tier three counties, which means poor counties, some of the poorest congressional districts in the country. And we've done this study, The Souls of Poor Folk, and it says, it's been verified, fact checked even by the Washington Post, 140 million poor and low wealth people in this country, 66 million white, 26 million black, 21 million of our elders, 30-some million of our children, 64% of Latinos, Latinx, and Asian. And then I wanted to just make this note. We have 7 people died from vaping, and we called it a national emergency. 250,000 people die every year from poverty, 700 people a day. A third of the poor live in the South, a third of the poor white people live in the South. South Carolina, where you just came from, over 40% of the people are poor. Here's a question that we're pushing, and we're pushing this with every candidate, because we've heard these consultants say that poor people don't want to be called poor, and we're meeting poor people that say, that's not what we want. We know we're poor. We don't like a nation ignoring us and not calling our name. Why is there not a focus on poverty and low wealth? I mean, a focus, not as an aside, not in special committees. And how is or how will your campaign be different in both naming and addressing poverty as a central part of the campaign? We talk about the middle class, we talk about the working class, but why is it so hard to get candidates, get this country to deal with 43% of its people living in poverty and low wealth and actually say their name and then address their condition?
Let me just say this. I have been in Congress for 30 years. I was a mayor of Burlington, Vermont, my home city, for 8 years. Reverend, do you know how many times the media has asked me, what am I going to do about poverty? I don't think it ever has. I'm followed by all this media. They will not ask me about income and wealth inequality. You know, they'll ask me about some dumb statement I may have made the other day or something. Well, what do I think about this or that? But I'm trying to think back, to be honest here. I honestly don't believe that I have ever been asked by media as to what we're going to do about poverty. That's a non-issue. That is a non-issue. And you go into Congress, same thing. Now, why is that? It is that I think in Congress, with some notable exceptions, candidates spend a whole lot of their time worrying about how they're going to raise the money they need from wealthy people. So a lot of candidates, it's no great secret, I'm not letting anything out of the box here, to tell you that, Democrats and Republicans, the leadership says you have to spend X number of hours a day. I don't know if you know this.
Oh, yeah.
They say you got to spend, whatever it may be, 10 hours a week on the phone. Here's a list of people. They're wealthy. Call them up and ask them for money because you got to get reelected. Republicans do it. Democrats do it as well. Candidates for president very often aren't at meetings like this because they're busy going to some billionaire's home raising substantial sums of money. And when you have that culture of getting money from well-off people, then you begin to hear about what the billionaires want. The billionaires got a lot of problems, you know. They need more tax breaks. They need more deregulation. They need to be able to buy even more mansions or whatever they do. And that's the kind of mentality that you have. So there's a whole area of need and thought that are not discussed. And the media is owned. They're good people. These people try hard. They're not enemies of the people with, you know, Donald Trump. It's disgusting and horrible and anti-democratic. It's not fake news. But they have been educated in their jobs to think that politics is if I attack you and you attack me, that's a big deal. Or if I slip on a banana peel, that becomes a big story. But if we talk about why 43 million people living in poverty, not so interesting.
140.
140, right. Not so particularly important. And what we are trying to do in this campaign is redefine what reality is in America and redefine what is important. And that's why I talk about the need to raise the minimum wage to a living wage so that nobody in America who works 40 hours a week lives in poverty. You know, that's at least $15 an hour. And the right of workers to join unions so they can collectively negotiate decent contracts. And equal pay for equal work so that women earn the same value for the work that they do. And then you get to the issue of healthcare. Your video focused on...
We're going to actually come to that question. Let me push a little bit, as I've done with all the candidates. And I understand that the debates, they don't ask the question.
No.
But our challenge to every candidate as a poor people's campaign is, what is the onus on the candidate and the party to say, listen, if there are 43% of this country living in poverty and 250,000 people that die every year, every time I'm on the stump, I'm going to at least say working class, poor, low wealth. What I see too often is even candidates, and I've challenged you and others even on this, I appreciate the working class piece, but at some point, we are going to have to say the name. And we've talked to people in, I was in Harlan County, Kentucky, and one guy who was there when Lyndon Baines Johnson went there for the poor people, for the war on poverty, and I asked him, why is it that so many people are not voting? Because, you know, 100 million people didn't vote. A whole lot of them are poor and low wealth. He said, nobody comes to see us and nobody talks about us. All we hear is middle class and wealthy and working class, and we never hear our names. How is it, and then Jonathan has a question, that you can be a part of changing just the mention of it? Because in America, if you're not in the narrative, you'll never be in the policy.
I would respond by saying we do our best on the very difficult schedules. I talk about these issues every day.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about, there was just a study came out, I may have been too conservative. In every speech that I give, I talk about how 30,000 people a year die because they don't get to a doctor when they should. I think that number is probably, there's another study that came out that it's a lot higher than that. But your point is well taken. We have tens and tens and tens of thousands of people who died for a variety of reasons, which are all unnecessary. It has to do with poverty, poor housing, lack of health care. So also what we try to do in our campaign, I don't think I took my campaign to Harlan County, but we have been to the lowest in 2016 in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the poorest county in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we have gone to Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, where the life expectancy is, 45 years or something like that, the lowest in the whole country. We've gone to low-income housing projects in the Bronx, where elevators are breaking down and people live on the 15th floor, can't get out of their apartments if they're old. So we do try, I think we can do better, but we do try to talk about a reality of American life that you don't see much on TV or you don't hear discussed in the Congress.
Well, we're glad to hear that you want to hear questions, because we have folks in this campaign who want to speak directly to these issues and to hear how your campaign's policies would address them. So let me invite folks who are here from Raise Up North Carolina to come and ask a question about wages, which you've already mentioned.
Hello. Hello, my name is Keenan Harton, and I'm part of Fight for 15 in the Union. And I work at Biscuitville, and I make $8 an hour.
You work where?
Biscuitville.
Okay.
And I make $8 an hour.
You make $8 an hour?
My name is Sarah Farrington. I'm also with Fight for 15 in Union. I'm currently employed at Waffle House, where I make $3.10 an hour plus tips.
Would you repeat that again so that everybody hears it?
Yes, my name is Sarah Farrington. I currently work at Waffle House in Durham, North Carolina, where I make only $3.10 an hour plus tips and work plus 40 hours a week.
Poverty is a moral crisis in America, and we can't pretend that it just impacts black and brown. It also impacts whites, too. There's 140 million poor people in America. There's 4 million in North Carolina.
Mm.
That's 43% of our state. It's just not fair. This also affects black, brown, native, LGBTQ communities. As president, what would you do to address poverty?
Let me tell you what I have already done. I'll tell you what I will do as the president. 4 years ago, I ran for president, and I came here to North Carolina. And you know what I said 4 years ago? I said, we got to raise the minimum wage to at least $15 an hour. I believe I was the first national politician to ever say that. And I was told that I was crazy, that I was an extremist, because the federal minimum wage was then and is now 7 1/4.
And in Congress, some of the boldest ideas were, well, maybe we can go to 10-10 an hour. And then somebody said, you know, I think maybe we could even go to $12 an hour. And I said, no. If you're talking about a minimum wage, it should be a living wage. Not that you're going to get rich on 15 bucks an hour, but at least you'll have a little bit of security and dignity. Now, you know what's happened since? Since that, 4 years ago, working with the Fight for 15 and the SEIU union, and this is where struggle ends up bearing results, Reverend. Since that time, 4 years ago, seven states in this country have raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Dozens and dozens of communities around America have raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. As President of the United States, one of my first orders of business will be to make sure that both the House and the Senate raise that minimum wage. The House did vote on my legislation. I have legislation in Congress. Friends introduced it in the House. I've introduced it in the Senate. The House did pass it. But under Republican rule in the Senate, we have not gotten a vote on that. As President of the United States, I will work tirelessly to make sure that we raise that minimum wage to at least $15 an hour, because I believe that anybody in America who works 40 hours a week should not live in poverty. That's what I will do. That's what I have. Ah, and I want to say something else, is that I helped work with workers at Amazon, owned by the wealthiest guy in the world, work with workers at Disney, go to Disneyland or Disney World. You know those people who walk around with Mickey Mouse uniforms? They're making starvation wages. We work with them and put pressure on Amazon and Disney to raise their minimum wage, 400,000 workers, to 15 bucks an hour. So that's what I have done, and as president, we'll complete that project and make sure that nobody in America who works 40 hours a week lives in poverty by raising the minimum wage to at least 15 bucks an hour, and we'll deal with this tip business.
That's right.
All right, which is absolutely crazy. All right, we can't have a minimum wage, what is it, 3 1/4 or something?
That's me, don't worry.
Okay.
Yeah, 3.10.
And if it's a bad day and nobody comes in, that's what you're making, right? All right, that is you know, unforgivable. We're going to raise tip wages to the minimum wage as well. So that is what I have done, and that is what I will do.
Senator Sanders, one of the things, our budget, we produced a budget, a poor people's moral budget, and we've actually flipped the question of not what does it cost to fix these things, but what does it cost not to do them?
Sure.
Like if you don't raise to 15, it keeps $368 billion, I think somewhere around there, out of the economy.
Right.
I want at some point at the end for you to talk about the cost of poverty, like Joseph Stiglitz and we met with, the cost of poverty, because too often people talk about what does it cost to fix it. The cost to leave it like it is worse than the cost to fix it. Yeah. And if you would talk some, but I want to, for a moment, ask this question, then we're going to do it maps.
You know, I'm just thinking, if I could interrupt
okay,
you. You know, I'm just thinking about, I don't know if anybody saw it, there was kind of a raucous debate last night.
That's what you call it.
I have to keep ducking and weaving. I'm afraid people would throw things in my head, but you know, I'm just thinking, this issue that this gentleman and woman raised, it's an issue that millions of people say, yeah, you're right. Did that issue even come close to being discussed last night?
Yeah.
Not even close, not even close.
Well, you know, we've argued that there needs to be a whole different, and we've had candidates that said they committed, you were one of them, to a full televised debate just on poverty, but we really believe the whole, let's stop having commentators ask the question, have real people ask the question.
I believe
that's
you.
What we really ought to be doing. And but
let me bring in a few more real people
right.
before we go to these maps, because you know, addressing the wage issue is huge. But part of the challenge that we see all across the country as you talk to people is that, you know, in addition to wages not going up, the expenses of many things have skyrocketed. And one of those things is health care. So we have some folks here who wanted to ask a question about health care. Please introduce yourselves, and then Leslie's going to ask the question.
And your storyline. Thank you so much.
I am Dr. Naveed Aziz, and I practice medicine in Cumberland County. in North Carolina. And let me tell you, Senator, no one has ever won the state of North Carolina without winning Cumberland County. Having said that, I run a free clinic at my office, and I see patients after patients who have to decide between buying their medications and buying their groceries. I have actually seen patients getting amputated and getting blind and having massive heart attacks and strokes because of simple diseases like diabetes and hypertension. And when I see them for free and I write a prescription for them and they go and get the prescriptions filled, insulin, you know how much it costs? When Benting and Best invented insulin, they gave it for $1. And look at now the price of insulin. So what are you going to do to make these insurance companies and drug manufacturing companies to come down and be affordable to poor people?
All right, we want everybody to say who you are and why you're here, and then you can respond.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Barber. I'm 26 years old. When I was 2 years old, I was diagnosed with a brain condition, and I was operated on and treated. A lot of times people don't know I have a pre-existing condition unless I tell them. And I know that I'm standing here today because I had access early, and I was able to be treated early. And I think that's what everybody else deserves. So I'm just standing here in solidarity with everyone, the millions of other people with pre-existing conditions.
Thank you.
Excuse me. My name is Perry Morgan, and I'm here because throughout my career working with patients, I've seen how hard it is for poor people to access health care, and I've also seen how much they can suffer when they don't. I'm also here because I've seen firsthand that it takes more than health care to make people healthy, as we've spoken about before, and that poverty is the enemy of health. And I know that you ask about health care a lot on the stump, and as you've just said, not very much about poverty. But I'm here to say I really think those issues have to be considered hand in hand as you go forward.
Thank you.
Senator, my name is Leslie Boyd. This is my son, Michael, who died 12 years ago on April 1st from lack of access to health care. Every year now, I go through these final 6 weeks of his life. And I think 12 years ago today that our final hope of saving him was dashed. When the cancer came back, we went to see three doctors 12 years ago today, hoping that one of them could do something that might give us a little more time with him. And we found out on this day 12 years ago that that was not to be. And like Callie Greer, I held my son as he died, and I have never recovered, and I never will. You said somewhere around 30,000 Americans die every year. A Yale study just found that 68,000. That's one every 8 minutes. One every 8 minutes. A 500,000 human souls since the death of my son. And so I want to ask you, I want to start by saying North Carolina is a state where the legislature has refused to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. So 500,000 people who should have access to health care do not. 350,000 of those people are white. More than 100,000 are black. 40,000 of them have served in the military, and 3 of them will die today, and 3 more tomorrow, and 3 more every day until we expand Medicaid. Even if we had Medicaid expansion tomorrow, there are still hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians who are either uninsured or unable to use their insurance because of high deductibles. Often when we talk about access to health care for every American, we debate how much it will cost. Our moral budget has found the money. But the question we want you and other candidates to answer is, what does it cost America not to insure all of us? Right. America can't address the moral crisis of poverty without addressing health care. What is your plan to guarantee access to health care to every single human being in this country?
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Senator?
Well, you know, I think back again to the debate that I had last night, which is one of 10 debates that have taken place. No one has asked that question. None of the moderators have. Question that I'm often asked as an advocate for Medicare for All, I'm asked every debate, how are you going to pay for it and all that stuff? We argue about that, and my opponents say I'm not telling the truth or I'm underestimating the cause. But no one has said, Senator, do you think we have a moral obligation to make sure that nobody in this country dies unnecessarily because they don't have health care? That question never asked me. Never asked me by the media. Not once you watch the debates, not once being asked in the debates. So, as somebody who has studied this issue, who maybe has been a leader in the nation on this issue, let me say a few words about it. Prescription drugs. You mentioned insulin. 6-8 months ago, I took a trip from Detroit, Michigan to Windsor, Ontario with a busload of people from the Midwest who were diabetic. Okay? We went to a pharmacy in Windsor, Ontario to buy insulin, the same exact product made by the same exact company as people used in the United States. Do you know what the differential in price was between Canada and the United States? 10 times. We pay 10 times more for the same exact product that was sold in Canada. Why is that? Because the pharmaceutical industry essentially owns the United States government. We don't regulate the pharmaceutical industry, they regulate the Congress. Go to the website and check it out, and you'll find that the pharmaceutical industry over the last 20 years has spent billions of dollars on campaign contributions and on lobbying. So they hire the former leaders of the Republican Party, the former leaders of the Democratic Party, and right now, Doctor, as you well know, the drug companies can charge any price they want. No control at all. So if some of you have been using a drug for 20 years, you may walk into the pharmacy tomorrow and the pharmacist says, well, prices have doubled. How come? Why? Because they can. Nobody can stop them. All right? I will stop them. I will stop them. They are greedy and they are corrupt. Because in terms of insulin, it's not just greed. Greed I'm familiar with. They are engaging in price fixing in insulin. As a matter of fact, the three manufacturers that produce about 90% of the insulin sold in America, they engage in price fixing. We don't have an attorney general who has the guts to go after them because they're too powerful. This state and my state and West Virginia and New Hampshire, states all over this country have suffered from the opioid epidemic, yes? Do you know what the response of the opioid manufacturers, companies like Purdue, was when they learned definitively that the product that they were selling was addictive and killing people? You know what their response was? They hired more salesmen to sell more product. They were making money hand over fist. So you have an industry which is corrupt. Which is engaging, by the way, in criminal behavior. We will deal with that when I'm elected president. But right now, understand their power. They have extraordinary power. Last year, while 1 out of 5, doctor, you mentioned your own patients, what the statistics tell us, this is so unbelievable, speaking to a dysfunctional healthcare system. Who can believe what the doctor just said? She writes out a prescription because you've diagnosed the illness, right? Well, what good is your prescription if somebody can't afford to fill it? So they go to you, they learn they're sick, but they can't afford to fill it. 1 out of 5 Americans cannot afford to fill the prescriptions their doctors write. And 6 drug companies last year made at least $69 billion in profit. This is a corrupt system. Now I want to deal with healthcare, okay, in general. Prescription drugs are an important part of it, but not the only part. 4 years ago, I came to North Carolina and to other states around the country, and I proposed a very, very radical idea. You ready, Reverend? I don't want you to fall off that chair here.
That's right. Well, you know, I read the Bible. Come on, let's see what.
All right, here's the radical idea.
Well, I read some pretty radical
The radical stuff. Idea is that healthcare is a human right, not a privilege. Yes. Oh, my God. Oh, Bernie, how radical can you be? What an extremist communist. Oh, my God. Imagine that, that people in America, when they're sick, can walk into the doctor's office regardless of their income. I mean, how revolutionary is that? Meanwhile, that exists in virtually every other major country on Earth. Now, the healthcare industry doesn't tell you that. Media doesn't talk about it. But the fact is, I live in Burlington, Vermont. I'm living 50 miles away from the Canadian border. Last I heard, Canada wasn't a communist country, wasn't a socialist country, very much like us. But decades ago, because they had some courageous politicians, by the way, who took on the establishment there, they passed what they call Medicare as well. In Canada, you go to any doctor you want, and you know what? You don't take out your wallet. You don't take out your credit card. You all know that? And if you end up in a hospital with cancer or a serious illness, do you know how much it costs you when you come out? Anyone know? How many? Anybody know?
Zero.
Zero. And then, on top of all of that, do you know how much the Canadians are spending per person, doctor, on health care compared to the United States? We're spending half as much as we spend. We spend $11,000 for every man, woman, and child. Outrageous sum of money. Canadians are spending half of that. Somehow they provide health care to all of their people. Their people live longer than our people. Their infant mortality rate is lower. So why is it that we spend twice as much per capita and 87 million people are uninsured or underinsured? Your point about being insured doesn't mean anything if you have a $5,000 or $10,000 deductible. You still can't afford to go to the doctor. We don't talk about that too much. You're insured on paper, but in reality, you still can't go to the doctor. So this is what Medicare for All is about. We get rid of all premiums. We get rid of all co-payments. We get rid of all deductibles. We get rid of all out-of-pocket expenses. And because we're going to lower the cost of prescription drugs significantly, nobody in America has to pay more than $200 a year for the prescription drugs they need. We fund it publicly in a progressive way. It is not free. Healthcare is expensive. And then we have various options out there. We pay for it. But today, when we talk about healthcare, and the media doesn't talk about this at all, I'm asked, how are we going to pay for it? And I got options to pay for what I'm proposing. You know how we pay for it today? Anybody here paying a premium? Raise your hand. Anybody here pay co-payments? Anybody pay out-of-pocket expenses? Anybody here pay outrageously high cost of prescription drugs? That's how you're paying for it today. And here is the truth. The average American family, the family in the middle of our economy, makes $60,000 a year. That family now is paying $12,000 a year for health care. 20% of their entire income just for health care. Last year, the healthcare industry made $100 billion in profit. Function of healthcare is to provide healthcare to all, not to make huge profits for the drug companies and the insurance companies. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Senator. This is the kind of detail that we've been asking of every candidate, so as you're thinking about that. And I do want to take a one thing and say, you know, Senator Sanders, and this is not about an endorsement or anything, but it's about a truth. You know, I get so tired of people who want to scare folk raising this thing about socialism. Ronald Reagan called, when Medicare and Medicaid was about to be put in place, he described it as socialism. Right. It's an argument that goes all the way back to the New Deal and, right. and people who did not want the New Deal, who did not want minimum wage. So let's stop playing the games and have serious policy conversations about how we get something done. And the Poor People's Campaign has said fundamentally, as we've told every candidate, our concern is how everybody not has access, but has health care, because I have access to a Rolls Royce if I go on a Rolls Royce parking lot, but I don't have a Rolls Royce.
All right, let me just pick up on that. I mean, this is the point. It's not a question of health insurance. It's a question of being able to walk into a doctor's office. And if you have to go to a hospital, getting that care as well.
And so I think this is a debate we have to have, particularly with so many people talking about faith. You know, as a Christian, I hear all these people talking about faith, but the guy I serve, he healed every leper and never charged him a copay. So I'm always confused about people who don't even want to have the conversation and think that ought not be a major, just like poverty ought to be a centerpiece. And candidates are doing now. Two things I want to ask you. I want to look at some math.
I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second.
All right.
I know, it's hard to interrupt this guy. I know that.
Well, I don't have my pulpit up here, so you can interrupt today.
All right. See, we have already, and I want you, this gets back to the very first point you made, what we discuss or not. Just tonight, in this church, we have had more serious discussion about the issues that impact the American people in the half hour we've been up here than I have had in 10 debates. All right?
And that's all we want.
Nobody in the 10 debates, to the best of my memory, and sometimes I forget things, but to the best of my memory, nobody asked me, Senator, what are you going to do, if president, to make sure that everybody has a living wage in this country? That question has never been asked to me by the media. Mm-hmm. Nobody has ever asked me, what are you going to do to make sure that health care is a human right? That question has never been asked. Yeah. But your point is right. When you have ordinary people coming up talking about the reality of their lives, somehow the question is different than what media poses.
Also, that means text Moral, M-O-R-A-L, to 90975 that they connected with the Poor People's Campaign. Senator, we have identified five issues, moral issues, that if they're not addressed are constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, and economically insane. Poverty, systemic racism, ecological devastation, the war economy, militarism, and the false moral narrative of religious nationalism. We start with racism for a particular reason, but we don't start with if somebody calls somebody the N-word or that. As Ibram Kendi said, insulting racism is most often a cover over policy. So when we talk about racism, we're talking about voter suppression, resegregation of public schools, mass incarceration, taking Native Americans' lands and opening them up for drilling, and the continuing injustice towards immigrant brothers and sisters, particularly from Mexico and Africa, because the children and the people are still in the prisons down south right now, even though the media may not be paying attention. But I want to take this one, two questions. One is would you consider send them back over in Pitt County? He was in a county that didn't vote for him, where poor black folk and poor white folk came together and did not support his candidacy. But most media didn't realize that because they just said it was the South, right? And they don't really know us down here. Huh? Some of us are trying to make the South rise again, but not the old way, but in a new way. Right. And that's why when they say, well, Senator Sanders is coming to a black church, I say, first of all, our church is brick. It has white inside and chandeliers and blue carpet. Yes, I am black, but I am a Christian, and we have black and white and gay and straight. You are in one of the few congregations that's fully affirming in the South. We welcome all people of every race, creed, color, and sexuality. However, we know in this movement, we start with systemic racism because systemic racism in so many ways blocks us from getting to the policies that you're talking about. I want to show you some maps, and I want to ask after that, what are your, number one, will you have your campaign experts produce a piece that shows if your policies are implemented, how it will close the wealth gap between black people and Latinos and whites, and secondly, how it will close the wealth gap for us country folk in rural America? That's the question. That's a yes or no. And then the second one is, let's look at these maps. Now, you're in the state that after Shelby and Section 5 was gutted, one of our legislators said, now that the headache has been removed, we can do what we want to. And they didn't engage just in disparate treatment. They did intentional racism. And I've challenged all of the candidates that have come through here. If you come through North Carolina and don't talk about systemic racism and voter suppression and racist gerrymandering, you haven't really come through North Carolina. That's not, because it's not just a black issue, it is this issue. Now, here are the maps. Here's the map. Here are all the states, long before Donald Trump, 2010, that have passed racist voter suppression laws. We ought to have up there also Kentucky and Alaska. And since 2013, some of these have gotten exacerbated. That those states just in the South represent over 170 electoral votes and 26 members of the United States Senate and 31% of the House in just the 13 or 14 former southern states. But here's the thing, Senator, we're trying to get people to see. Next slide. The same states that have the worst racist voter suppression are the poorest state. Not black poorest state, just poorest states. Next slide. Same states are the worst child poverty states. Next slide. Same states are the worst women in poverty state. The next one. The same states that refuse to pass a living wage and elect Congress people and senators who won't support it come from the states that have the worst racist voter suppression. The same states that just, before we could even get to health care for everybody, the same states that wouldn't even support Medicaid expansion are the same states that, through gerrymandering and racist voter suppression, create what one judge has called unconstitutionally constituted legislatures and congressional delegations through surgical racism. Next one. So here's the question we have. If, in fact, the people who get elected through racist voter suppression, once they get elected, they use their power mostly to hurt poor white people in raw numbers, because there's 40 million more poor white people than there are poor black people in raw numbers. Now, in percentage, you know, that's different. If that's the game they're playing, and Dr. King told us that would always be the game whenever black and white and brown people could come together, particularly out in the South, and build political power. As president, we've asked every candidate this, what is your plan to deal with systemic racism as it is played out through voter suppression and racialized gerrymandering? Because if we don't deal with that, we can't even obtain the power to deal with the other things.
Well, thank you for the question, and thank you for articulating the crisis. What I often say as a politician, somebody who has run for office many, many times, it really disgusts me that we have Republican governors and secretaries of state who don't have the guts to run for office on their record, on their ideas. Now, if you want to go out to the people and say, you know, I'm running for office, and I want your vote, and I want to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, ignore climate change, throw people off healthcare, and by the way, give huge tax breaks for billionaires, please vote for me. Fine, make your case. But what really bothers me is they think the only way they can win is to suppress the vote. And you're right. As soon as the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, within days, there were attorneys general all over the country.
45 minutes in North Carolina.
45 minutes. Yeah.
They had it ready.
Ready to go. To make it harder for people to vote so they can maintain big money control over the state. All right? And certainly we have a president who is very sympathetic to that. So what do we do? For a start, I will have a Department of Justice and an Attorney General that will go after every state in this country that engages in voter suppression. We're going to end voter suppression. And there are a variety of ways to do it, but the bottom line is, if you are 18 years of age and a citizen of the United States of America, you have the right to vote. Okay? There are countries around the world where people are automatically registered. You know, you don't have to fill out 12 forms. You don't have to wait on a line. You are registered. You know, no one asks you whether you want to pay taxes or not. Somehow or another, they figure that out, right? Well, we can figure out who is 18 and a citizen and make sure that they are eligible to vote. And the other thing we could do is make sure that when people go to vote, they don't have to wait online for 2 hours in order to vote. We'll make it easier for people to vote. I have long supported the idea of making Election Day a holiday. Okay. Reverend, as you know, we have one of the lowest voter turnout rates of any major country. And there are countries where 70, 80% or more of the people vote. We're not anywhere near that. So we will take on this racist voter suppression. And by the way, in states like New Hampshire, it's not race. It's they don't want young people to vote. All right. But we will take on all obstacles that prevent people from voting. We will do everything that we can to encourage, to make it easier for people to vote. Again, I want to see this country have the highest voter turnout of any country on earth, not the lowest.
Let me push on one thing on this. So even in a state like North Carolina, where a unconstitutionally constituted legislature becomes such because the Justice Department pre-cleared a gerrymandering plan that was later, after we fought the NAACP Tomorrow Monday movement, North Carolina NAACP Tomorrow Monday movement forward justice, and had it overturned. So they also rolled back laws that were already being used by citizens. We won early voting. When they got the legislature, they rolled it back. But they got there because they didn't have the gerrymandering plan was allowed through, and the judges are now saying it's racist. They rolled back 17-year-old voting. They stood in the courtroom and said, because Section 5 is no longer the law of the land, pre-clearance, retrogression was legal. They came after all these voter ID plans and said, we're not even going to allow a student with a North Carolina Central student ID to be able to vote. Here's what I want to push on, and I'm pushing all of the candidates on this. If we don't start talking about this nationally, and I'm very serious about this, and we are in our campaign, we have some idea what Russia did, but we know exactly what in the hell voter suppression has done. And I can't understand for the life of me how we are talking all about Russia, an external threat, and not talking about an internal threat, when it's not William Barber or some or just our movement that's saying it was surgical racism. The courts have. And I don't know why candidates aren't saying, first thing I'm going to do today, for instance, is 2,437 days since the Congress could have fixed the Voting Rights Act. In other words, McConnell, Boehner, and Ryan, and then Democrats who haven't pushed hard enough, have let the Voting Rights Act stay enforced since June 25th, 2013. That's 2,437 days today. Strom Thurmond, where you just came from South Carolina, Strom Thurmond, former senator of South Carolina, filibustered the Civil Rights Act of 1957 one day, and we called him a racist. Boehner, Ryan, McConnell have filibustered, in essence, fixing the Voting Rights Act for 2,437 days. I have yet to hear on a national stage, in a major way, candidates say, day one, we're going to fight to fully restore the Voting Rights Act and ensure that at least the former states are included up front. Because if you create a formula that doesn't include all the states, every state that was included since 1965, Senator Sanders, you know this, they could have gotten out. All they had to do was not suppress the vote and be racist for 10 years. And they would have been automatically removed from pre-clearance. None of them could resist it, even when the legislators were Democrat. So pressure is not just to stop black folk, but to undermine black and white and brown people from voting together in major ways to change this country. Where will you be on the Voting Rights Act?
We're going to restore it. We're going to do more than restore it.
Okay.
All right. As I said before, here is my goal. Let me lay it out. I want the United States to have the highest voter turnout participation of any major country on earth. We're going to make it easier in a dozen different ways for people to participate in the political process. And by the way, it is everything that you said, but it is even more. There is a cultural view in this country. My vote doesn't matter. Why should I vote? Well, we're going to deal with that as well. And we're going to deal not only with voter suppression and extreme gerrymandering, we're going to deal with a corrupt political system which allows billionaires to buy elections. All right?
All right.
I happen to be old-fashioned, and I believe in democracy being one person, one vote.
One vote.
That's what we're going to strive for.
And we're going to continue to push out what the Poor People's Campaign, we have 10 demands that we're making. I also want to say, and then Jonathan has one question, and I have a final one, and that is that as we are looking at these issues, particularly around voting, we know, for instance, in every state, we have a study coming out that shows if you registered and could move 2 to 10% of poor and low-wealth people and bring them an expanded electorate, you could fundamentally change. We know that, for instance, in North Carolina in 2016, Trump won by 50,000 votes. 500,000 African-Americans didn't vote, over a million white people, but we had 154 fewer voting sites because of voter suppression, even on college campuses, right? And we also know that the number of adult-age poor and low-wealth people far outdistance the margin of victory, but hardly anybody ever. They're telling us, poor people are telling us, we don't hear our name, and therefore we can't trust that people, when they get in office, if they can't say our name now, how can they include us in their policies then? And so that's how critical it is to move this electorate. Jonathan has one other question. Senator, thank you for taking this time with us here in Eastern North Carolina.
So this power that's gained by subverting democracy is being used to target particular populations right now. Certainly immigrants is one. You 2 years ago visited in Durham at the church where I serve, Pastor Jose Chigas, who's been in sanctuary there. And he's one example of a family that has been separated, not just at the border, but all around this country by extreme ICE enforcement. That's immigration. Another way we see people being targeted is our friends down in Arizona who are part of the Oak Flat campaign there, the Apache Nation, but they're trying to claim, they're reclaiming Oak Flat because the federal government has handed that land over to people who want to mine it for copper. So whether it's our native and indigenous sisters and brothers, our immigrant sisters and brothers, there are populations that are being targeted, and the federal government is directly involved in that. So as president, what would you do to intervene in these kinds of situations where people have been directly targeted?
Well, as somebody who, for a variety of reasons, thinks that climate change is an existential threat, all right, we are going to end all fossil fuel excavation on public lands in general. And as somebody who believes that the Native American, that the treaties signed by the Native American people have been abrogated time and time and time again, and your point is well taken, we're seeing large corporations come into Indian country, destroy the water, destroy their sacred burial grounds in order to excavate. We will respect the treaty obligations of the United States government with regard to the Native American people. That's something I take very seriously. And in terms of immigration, what Trump is trying to do, which is what demagogues always do, is try to divide people up by the color of their skin, or maybe their religion, or the country of origin, or their sexual orientation, or whatever it may be. And what we will do is do exactly the opposite of what Trump is going to do, is doing. We're going to bring people together. And in terms of immigration reform, this is what we are going to do. You mentioned these ICE raids that are terrorizing communities. We will end them. We're going to end the ICE raids. Number two, on day one, through executive order, we will restore the legal status of the 1.8 million young people and their parents eligible for the DACA program. We will... And as the son of an immigrant, we are going to end the demonization of the immigrant community. You know, you know this, Reverend. You're a good student of history, as I'm sure you are, Jonathan. This is what history has always been, right? We play white, poor whites off against blacks, right?
That's right.
Now, 50, 80 years ago, here in the South, you know who the lowest paid white workers were in America? They were right here in the South.
Right here in the South, yeah.
They had low wages, but what did they have? They could go to a water fountain that an African-American couldn't. Boy, I'm superior. I don't have any money. I can't send my kid to healthcare. I can go to that water fountain. Wow, I'm pretty good, right? All right, that's the kind of games they play. And now what Trump is doing is saying, okay, we're going after the undocumented. Hey, we're supposed to hate the undocumented. And by the way, if I may say so, before he was president, Trump didn't quite hate the undocumented because he hired hundreds of them so that he could exploit them in his resorts. He loved them then. All right. And ultimately, what we have got to do is pass comprehensive immigration reform, which I think we can do. It's what the American people want, and a path toward citizenship for the undocumented. But most importantly, and I know this is what you preach every day, is that we have got to bring people together. We share a common humanity. You're black, you're white, you're Latino, you're Asian American, you're Native American, you're gay, you're straight, who cares? All right? We all have basic human needs. We all want a good life for our kids and for our parents. And we cannot let demagogues try to divide us up. We stand together around an agenda that works for all of us, not just wealthy campaign contributors. Thank you.
One of the ways, Senator, thank you. One of the things we believe in the Poor People's Campaign is that the five issues that can work like a magnet to bring people together are having grown-up conversations about systemic racism and policy addressing poverty, ecological devastation, this war economy, and this false moral narrative of religious nationalism that says all God is concerned about in public square is a woman's right to choose, is prayer in the schools, is tax cuts and guns, and not the poor and the least of these. We relieve the rejected, gonna have to lead the revival. And I would just say it like this. Whether you're black or you're white or you're brown or you're red or you're yellow or you're gay or you're straight or you're young or you're old or you're rural or you're urban, guess what? We do care. We all care about each other, and we're not gonna allow somebody to turn us against each other, because then it's not just about an election, it's whether or not America can even be who she claims to be. I want you to hear this video, because you get called something a lot, and I want you to respond to this, the last question. It's not my words, I believe them deeply in some ways that we can transpose them even to this 21st century. Some words from Dr. King. Dr. King, some words that Dr. King said years ago. In fact, it was in 1963. It was before the March on Washington. It was before the Birmingham victory. He was sitting in jail. It was before I Have a Dream. It was before four little girls were blown up 17 days after the March on Washington and 15 days after my birth. And Dr. King said something that I believe right now, regardless of who you're supporting, every American, every politician ought to hear. And I want you to hear it tonight and then respond to it. And then we have some young people who are going to come and present you our budget and our because we found the money, by the way. We found out, we went searching. We got a bunch of economists and some good folk, and we went snooping around, and we found it in the defense budget, and we found the money. We found that people are lying, media, when they say there's scarcity. And the question really is, how much does poverty cost, not how much does it cost to fix it? And we put a budget together and presented it before the Budget Committee of the United States Congress, right? And so, and just as an aside, when we did that, one of the Congress people got so mad, he said, why are you all here as Christians? I'm a Christian, and I never saw any place in the Bible where Jesus said anything to Caesar. And I said, wait a minute, let's stop talking about the budget for a minute. Did you just define yourself as Caesar? Because if that's who you, that's how you understand politics, and your idol is to be Caesar, we really have some problem in America. But hear these words and then respond to them in your own personal way for 2 or 3 minutes, and then these young people are going to come up. Bring it up.
To you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you on the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believes he can set the...
Washington for the March for Jobs and Freedom with Dr. King spoke.
You never have to apologize for age. It's what you do with your age. It's not how...
But his point is well taken. What we have got to do is not... We want to transform this country. This is the wealthiest country in the history of the world. There is no excuse for so many of our black and brown and white brothers and sisters to be living in poverty. There is no moral explanation for why 87 million of us are uninsured or underinsured, why schools all over this country are providing inadequate education to low-income kids. And when we talk about urgency, what the scientists tell us, there is no moderate approach to climate change. That we must be extraordinarily bold if we want to make sure that the planet we leave our kids and grandchildren, I have 7 grandchildren, and future generations, is a planet that is habitable and healthy. So I think we speak to the urgency of the moment, the pain that is out there, not only in our country, but around the world, and the fervent hope that the United States of America can once again be a moral leader for justice in our own country and a forthright leader for democracy and justice all over the world. That's the challenge that we face, and that is why I'm running for president.
Thank you so much. As our young people prepare to come, Senator Sanders, one of the things we say in our movement is the issue is not what I can do, but what we can do when we stand together, fight together, and move together. And another thing we quote is from William Lloyd Garrison, when Garrison said, tell a woman, he was an abolitionist, he said, tell a woman in a burning house to be moderate. But when it comes to justice, I will not be moderate, and I will be heard. And then Frederick Douglass said, after the Dred Scott decision, when people said everything is over, he said, no, maybe this is just one chain, one link in the chain preparatory to the downfall of the whole system. Therefore, we must embolden and intensify our agitation. I want these young folk who are part of the campaign to come and present you a copy of The Souls of Poor Folk. We have our stuff footnoted because we think the worst thing you can do is be loud and wrong. And so we have footnotes when we say 140 million. And we have this budget, this moral budget. We don't endorse, but we will be looking at ideas. We will be looking at every candidate that's running based on where they stand on this budget and this agenda. Because poor and low wealth people are very smart. We know who to vote for by looking at who stands for the issues we care about. And if we can't be moderate as the climate is burning up, we can't be moderate as people's lives are being broken up. We have to stand together. At this time, I need you all, for security reasons, McCain, to stay seated. We're going to put a video up called With the Demands, Poor People's Campaign. Please do not move. They're not going to let out the door, even over on the other side. Please do not move over it, rebuilding broken places. Reverend Holmes, take this mic from me. He will have the final word for the evening and close us in church order. Amen. The choir will sing as you are departing. Bring that video up, The Demands. Give the center back.